you guys. Sorry I'm a little late. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My call is, my name is Dick. It is time to begin the TechNet on line mark. This will be TechNet number 1587 of the series that began in September of 1982. 33 years ago. You guys already know, you've heard it so often. The main purpose of the TechNet is education. It's a gathering of the clan. We teach each other how all this equipment works and how to make it work better. One of the complaints that I hear periodically is that, hey, you guys are repeating subjects. Well, after 33 years and 1,587 TechNets, there's definitely going to be some repeats. You've got to sort of expect that. But then the word repeat is a relative word. By that I mean, somebody can say, gee, you guys are always discussing antennas. I've heard that before. Oh, really? In my opinion, there are 5,000 kinds of antennas. Which ones did you hear discussing? Or, gee, you guys are discussing standing wave ratio again. Among the electronic engineers who have worked with radio circuits for 10 and 20 years, only a small percentage of them have a good working knowledge of what standing wave ratio really is, what causes it, what bad effects does it create, how do you solve it. There's a zillion ways of solving it. You can correct it at the source, you can correct it at the load, you can correct it all kinds of places. So, yeah, we discuss standing wave ratio rather frequently because it's an extremely misunderstood subject. But there's a zillion different ways of approaching it. Occasionally we may do it somewhat the same. My little discussion on how a dipole works. Without a doubt, it will sound repetitive from time to time. But to some degree, it requires repeating, justifies repeating, because no good book that I know of on the subject of antennas gives a good working knowledge of that. I have found an article recently by Richard Feynman, which comes close, but still there's missing ingredients as to what's really going on in there. So, is it really repetitive? And you be the judge. And your 2-meter handy-talkie with a synthesizer has got 800 channels. If this one pleases you, you can tune to one of the other 799, if you know what I mean. Okay, the way the TechNet works, we have this very loose schedule we follow, and we sometimes violate the daylights out of it, but that schedule is the first hour. We take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment for the net. And they give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, meaning they do have a question or a comment. After 33 years, we believe somebody is listening. And so you don't have to sign in saying that you're listening. We sort of accept that by now. After the first hour or so, it's followed by John, KC2WGB, who mans the mailbag. The mailbag really means people who don't yet have their ham radio license or don't have the right equipment, where they can talk to us directly. And so, by way of various methods, they message John and let us know what their questions are. And John chooses a few of those that have general interest. John also monitors the echo link, so if you have trouble signing in because we don't leave enough gap, John will know about it. And there are people who give messages during the net to John by way of a chat room. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert. And Paul gives us the latest on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing, as well as the European Space Agency and the Asian Space Agency and so on. And there's always a lot going on with NASA. And there's an amazing number of people who write John and me letters saying that that's one of their favorite sections. They really want to know what's going on in space. Let me drop. And there are two websites you can go to that support the TechNet. I call them Mike Number 1 and Mike Number 2. Mike Number 1, Mike Perry, KC2NJI, has a website that you can get to by way of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. And there, the last 10 years of TechNet are recorded, thousands of hours worth. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and it comes in 4 reels of 1 hour each, 4 or 5 reels, and you listen to those reels, and there are people who are not able to listen to the whole TechNet, which runs 4 hours most Sunday evenings. We start at 8 and usually wind down at 12 p.m. when the repeater literally gets turned off at my request. One's website. They can download the information that took place the previous Sunday, so to speak. You have to wait a few days, maybe Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of the week is when the latest recording appears on that website. Let me drop this. And they will download that into whatever recording device they're using so that they can listen to it while commuting on their lunch hour and so on. The other website is Mike number 2, and that's K1MJM. And his website is limartechnet.com, L-I-M-A-R-C, technet.com. And there you'll find quite a bit of supporting information with reference to the TechNet. Things like articles that have been written and pictures and, a Smith chart you can download, things like that. So these two websites of Mike number 1 and Mike number 2 give you additional information as to what's going on with the TechNet. So at this time we're going to have people sign in. We're going to give me your call letters, your name, try not to forget to give me your name because I'm so darn forgetful, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. So give us the check-ins right now. K2RIW listening.
W-H-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
Okay, we got Joe. Who's the next person?
82-HUC, Steve, yes.
Okay, we got Steve. Joe and Steve. Anyone else a check-in? Because you do have a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now.
It's DVZ with quick answers.
Al recognized, who quite often gives us the more brief subjects that I ramble on about. Anyone else to check into the technique? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2SHO, John in Mount Laurel, yes.
2WGB, John, with a radar question.
It's Jean. With a good info, will give us some information about Sirius, the dwarf power planet in our solar system. We are quite close now, and everything is like naked eye. Enjoy seeing.
Okay, we got SHO, John, WGB, John, and XJN, Wes. All right, let's start off with Joe, W2RYY. How have those electrons been treating you this week, Joe? K2RIW listening.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, Nat. W-H-Y-Y. I'd like to know how can a receiving antenna work very, very well on a particular band of frequencies for receiving, but yet work very, very poorly on transmit? And I'll give you an example later on this if you want details of it. Same thing with an antenna on a higher frequency called a disc cone, which actually seems to do almost the opposite. It receives almost as well as transmits on some frequencies across its usage of spectrum. The first antenna I'm talking about is a long wire antenna. I put one up purposely because I don't have my dipole constructed yet, and I wanted something just to be able to give me some, you know, really good receive capability on different bands, and it made a huge difference from what I ever had before. So back to you.
Okay, Hal, go ahead with your comment.
Okay, a long wire antenna is a random wire, will receive very well. Thing is, when you want to transmit, you have to have an antenna that's resonant, number one. The antenna that you with your transmitter has to match, you're not going to get any radiation off the antenna. So that's for your resonant antenna at multiples, wavelengths, and properly matched your feet. That's my comment.
Okay, that very noisy signal from Hal, I'll repeat what he was saying. And he was saying that for transmitting, it's got to be resonant. And for receiving, not necessarily does it have to be resonant. And the reason for the resonance on the transmitting is because our modern-day rigs, if they exceed 1.5 or 2 to 1 standing wave ratio, they will go into a cutback mode. Now, transmitting antenna and receiving antenna, there's a paradox going on here. All antennas obey reciprocity. That means whatever gain, pattern, side load level, polarization, all the characteristics you get when you use the antenna for transmitting, you get the exact same characteristics when you use the antenna for receiving. good common sense will therefore say a poor antenna for transmitting should be a poor antenna for receiving. Not at all. There's something funny going on here with that paradox. My way of wording it is that a receiver is extremely forgiving. That's one way of looking at it. There's another way of looking at it. Let me drop it. Every one of us, if we want to, can take a random length of wire, a clip lead or whatever, a couple of feet long, plug it into the center conductor of your UHF connector on the back of an HF rig, and just tune to, let's say, the 40 meter band, 7 megacycles, 7.2 megacycles. And you scan across the band, you'll hear signals, they sound beautiful, and now you disconnect that yucky antenna and connect a real 40 meter dipole, and the signals coming out of the loudspeaker sound almost the same. There's a big catch. When you use the real dipole, you'll see that the signal you're listening to might be running 10 dB over S9. When you're using that random length of wire, your signal strength might be running S2. Huge difference in signal strength. Yet they sound the same. How come? And the reason is that the receiver has got 120 decibels of gain because of the extremely high standing wave ratio of that non-resonant random length of wire that you laid on the bench, the wooden bench, the clip lead that you connected to the center conductor. It probably had a 500-to-1 standing wave ratio. It probably had, as a transmitting or receiving antenna, an extra 20 or 30 decibels of loss. But because the noise of the band, Mother Nature's QR Nancy noise of an antenna looking at the horizon, see something like 30 or 40 dB high in noise figure, when you're using an antenna that's very inefficient, you're getting, let's assume now the antenna is giving you a 25 dB loss compared to a good antenna. You're getting 25 dB less noise of the ionosphere, and you're getting 25 dB less signal that you're listening to. The automatic gain control of the receiver cranks itself up by 25 extra dB. Audio coming out of the loudspeaker sounds the same. You just don't get as much signal strength reporting on the S meter. Let me drop.
Repeater, timeout.
So it's the combination of a lot of noise on the horizon, and you're cutting down the noise and you're cutting down the signal by the equal amount, but they're both above the threshold of the receiver. The automatic gain control cranks itself up, and you hear a beautiful signal. Now you try to transmit into that random length of wire. Not a chance in the world. That 50-to-1 or 500-to-1 standing wave ratio, your transmitter will look at that modern-day HF transmitter and will go into the self-protect mode. It either cuts itself way back in power or literally turns off the transmitter entirely in order to protect the final stage. So, although the antenna has the exact same performance on transmit and receive, you can see that one way of looking at it is the receiver is very tolerant. Another way of looking at it is that you can tolerate a hell of a lot less noise and a hell of a lot less signal. You just crank up the automatic gain control gain in the receiver and it sounds the same. So, it's a paradox. But that exact same phenomenon, let me drop. That exact same phenomenon does not work on 432. On 432, your antenna looking at the horizon doesn't see 30 decibels of excess noise, equivalent to a 30 dB noise figure, so to speak. Probably a 100,000 degree Kelvin is what you're getting with an antenna noise power-wise on 7 megacycles. On 432, your antenna looking at the horizon sees 150 degrees Kelvin. It sees 1 dB noise figure, so to speak. You use an antenna that is 25 dB inefficient, you're going to see 24 dB less signal and 1 dB less noise, if you know what I mean. You're going to suffer. So you use an improper antenna on 432. If the antenna is 10 dB inefficient, all the signals you're going to listen to are 10 dB worse in signal-to-noise ratio. Whereas on HF, because the noise is so high in the band, because of the way the ionosphere is reflecting all of the thousands of thunderstorms, there's thousands of thunderstorms going on continuously somewhere in the world. Let me drop it. I have the nice news about that ionosphere is it's able to couple signals to you from thousands and tens of thousands of miles away when it comes to ham radio signals. That also includes all those static crashes from all those thunderstorms. So as you can see, there's quite a bit of different physics. But the simplistic way of looking at it is that an HF receiver is very forgiving to high noise figure, VHF, UHF receiver is not, and therefore a really yucky antenna, an HF, in some circumstances for receiving purposes, whether it be a discount or whatever, will work very well on HF frequencies. Does some of that make some sense, Joe? You might have some additional questions on this. W2RYY, good question. And by the way, that's a repeat question. We've coupled that, we've discussed that subject all 20 times in the last 30 years. Each time we've discussed it, though, a little bit differently. A different group of people were asking the question. And so if you want to be severe, you can say, hey, we've discussed that before. What percentage of the people listening at this time have heard that information and understood it, assuming that I'm correct? And if not, somebody's going to come along and correct me real fast. W2RYY, T2RYW. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. I understand what you're saying. It makes perfect sense. Except what I tried was with an experiment, and I made some measurements. You want to hear about that information. Was that irrelevant to the question?
Yeah, since you've got hard data that you've seen, as long as it doesn't go on for 20 minutes describing your hard data, give us the bottom line, so to speak, Joe. In other words, I made such and such measurements, and in this case it was strong, in this case it was weak. Don't give me the exact microvolts, but summarize it if you can. Go right ahead, Joe.
Well, that's hard to do for, you know, a scientist, you know, like you. Incoming signals, and I was using a very, very low frequency way out of the aperture band just for, you know, a point of reference to be able to test from, because it's, you know, it was just easier with my particular experiment that I conducted. Broadcast signals from, say, New York, listening to a fixed transmitter, I give an example, specifically 1010 winds. Through this antenna, it comes in about minus 40 dBm. Now, I tried to send a signal using my signal generator about plus 20 dBm on an adjacent spot on the dial, and just to curious to see how far I hear it away. I measured the return loss at that specific point frequency, and I had a return loss of about something like maybe minus 2, minus 3, or something like that, with the return loss bridge set. So I figured, well, you know, that's almost like a short circuit, or pretty bad, not complete short circuit. The funny thing was, putting in, say, like 100 milliwatts of power into a generator with an audio tone on it that has some way of identifying it, I could only hear that signal not even a half a mile away from the house. After that, it was gone, washed out. I tried the same kind of test on a much higher frequency in the FM broadcast band using a discount. And it seems to work, be a fairly wide range antenna as far as receiving. Doing the same kind of test into that antenna on a bare spot on the dial, I was able to hear the generator at about 3 miles away. Drastic difference in signal, how far it goes. You would not think VHF would go much further than long wave, but apparently in this case, there was a dramatic difference in signal, received signal. I'm using my car radio as a receiver, and it by itself is working perfectly on both bands, so that's not part of the question. Back to you, Dick. So that's what I did.
If you and I use the right kind of instrumentation, Joe, with a known antenna, which has a known antenna factor, a known effective capture area, a known gain, and so on, and we measured the amount of noise at 1 megacycle, winds 1010, you would be amazed how many microvolts of noise you're getting, equivalent to about a 30 or 40, maybe even a 50 decibel noise figure. In the case of the broadcast station, winds itself, I'm not sure, but maybe the actual broadcast antenna is located in the plains of New Jersey somewhere, 30 miles or so away from you, and you're getting a pretty good signal from them. But they're probably transmitting 50,000 watts to do it, and you have almost a line of sight between your QTH and their antenna, which is probably close to 1,000 foot high. You know, in other words, if you had a good telescope and you knew where to look, you can probably see the top of their antenna from your QTH, direct line of sight. And what's going on here is that you're fighting a tremendous amount of noise, and the so-called ground wave is there, but the real sky wave is what gives you the majority of the signal on those frequencies. And so you're not getting sky wave, so to speak, over that distance. So you're fighting a huge amount of noise on one mission cycle. Let me drop. And a very rough rule of thumb is that the noise falls roughly 60 dB per raptor. As you go up the band to higher frequencies, you get less and less noise. So the total amount of noise of the ionosphere on the FM band at roughly 100 megacycles versus the AM broadcast band at 1 megacycle, there could easily be 20 decibels difference in noise power. So the same amount of power of transmitting line of sight on 100 megacycles is going to appear to have a lot more range to your receiver. One way of looking at it is you could measure the receiver sensitivity in microvolts, and you may think that the two receivers are the same until you connect them to a real antenna. When the real AM antenna is connected to the real environment on your WINS 1010 radio, and now by way of a directional coupler or whatever, you pump in your signal generator and measure microvolts of sensitivity under working conditions, and do the same thing at 100 megacycles by way of a directional coupler or a key connector with the real antenna on FM, you again measure sensitivity under real working conditions, you'll be amazed how much difference there is. So noise of the background, QR Nancy or Mother Nature, is one of the major factors. There's also a lot of difference in the way a 1 megacycle will propagate versus the 100 megacycle signal will propagate. Back to you, Joe. WQRYY, QRIW.
Mother Nature did last weekend, that's for sure. But we're enjoying the nice weather now. I have a fast question for you regarding just random wiring antennas and so on and so forth. Is there a velocity factor for regular 600-volt building wire that you would stretch between two trees if you were trying to calculate how long to make it? And if there is, what is it? Back to you, KD2HUC.
Yeah, when you study the appropriate section of the ARRL antenna book or the radio amateurs handbook, handbook for radio amateurs, you'll find that the usual rule of thumb is that compared to free space wavelength and your dipoles that you'll likely set up, the number is 95%. Assume 95% velocity factor, and you'll come up with very close to the right resonant length, the right mechanical length to be electronically resonant at your favorite HF dipole frequency, and it also works for VHF. 95%, good rule of thumb. You're about to ask the question, does it change a lot if I leave the rubber insulation, on my 14-gauge household wire? If I leave on the rubber insulation versus take off the rubber insulation, does that change the velocity? Boy, he shows up beautifully on the map. So once again, please write down the signal strength that you heard, the time that you heard it, and please report it to LIMOC.org. The thickness of the rubber insulation on your 14-gauge wire is such an extremely infinitesimal fraction of a wavelength of thickness that if you did an exact experiment with five decimal places of accuracy, and you now measured the velocity factor of 14-gauge wire with and without the rubber insulation, without the rubber insulation, because of the loop you got at the end where the egg insulator was, you got some extra capacitance out there, it acts as if there's a 95% velocity factor. And if you left on the rubber and now did a very careful measurement, I think you'd measure 94.9, if you know what I mean, velocity factor, 0.1% difference, so to speak. Very little, because the thickness and wavelengths are so small. So a good round number, 95% velocity factor, will get you the right ballpark. There's a 492 or 495 number that people use where you divide that number by megahertz of operation, or is it kilohertz? I've forgotten that formula because I got my own way of calculating. Let me drop. And so, because you and I, Steve, have such an ability, by way of our antenna analyzer, by way of drawing the bathtub curve, in other words, measuring standing wave ratio by various means, as you turn the receiver from 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, 3.8 megahertz and so on, or 7.0, 7.1, 7.2, you plot the standing wave ratio versus frequency. And if you got it right, you'll get a bathtub-shaped curve. At the bottom of the curve is where the lowest visvar is. That usually represents the resonant frequency of your particular antenna, and therefore you know right away whether or not you should make it longer or shorter. So it's not a big deal, but those are some of the variables involved. KD2HUC, K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
DPZ with a comment.
Red, relative to what you talk about, Dick.
DPZ with a comment.
Go ahead. We got both Hal and Joe in that order. Go ahead, Hal.
The bathtub curve. It's thicker diameter material, and you're going to have a bigger bathtub. That's my comment.
Okay, I heard something. There's a third person who wants to give us a comment, but I'm going to go over to Joe first. W2RYY, go ahead, Joe.
This may be helpful to Steve if he's trying to construct an outside dipole, and considering if you're going to use it on one band, make one antenna for one band, or make multiple antennas. Because when I found that in constructing my model, which I modeled the first band to be resonant about 144 megahertz, as they put other wires underneath that part of the model, it changed the resonant frequency, even though the physical length didn't change. It moved the resonant frequency considerably higher in the band. So that's something to consider. You put other metallic stuff near the antenna, like running parallel to it, half the length of the antenna, like if you're going to construct multiple band antennas, it can change the resonance of the first band you're playing with. Back to you.
Lower, not higher.
No, it made the return loss curve go higher in frequency, not lower.
The antenna went lower. when you have another dipole put there in peril, maybe the return loss. I'm talking about the resonant frequency.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with them. I'm going to agree with Joe on this one. If you look at the curves of nearby antennas, so-called mutual impedance phenomenon, depending on the unequivalent of the other antenna, there are times when the adjacent antenna will increase your capacitor reactance, there are times when it will increase the inductor reactance. Depending on what the other object is, depending on what the space of the other object is, quite often it'll move it lower, and that's what Hal is saying. And maybe the lower happens 80% of the time, but maybe 20% of the time, depending on the conditions, it can go up. It can go in either direction. The resistive component can change. The reactive component can change in magnitude and change in polarity. Negative reactance really means capacitance. Positive reactance means inductance. Depending on the conditions, nearby resonant objects can move the frequency in either direction. Lower, most of the time. Not always. Is that somewhat what you've seen, Joe? The V2RYY? K2RYZ in the tech net?
That's exactly what I saw in my antenna model. As they put another band on top, another set of wires underneath the first set, it made the primary antenna frequency go up in frequency. And then for me to get the second set of wires resonant, they were considerably shorter in physical length than they would have been using a 0.95 figure for resonant frequency. So that's something that I saw happen, which is kind of odd.
Intuition.
Have you built up multi-band dipoles where nearby move the frequency? Is that what you're about to say, Wes? And 2XJN, K2LAW.
I found interesting moment in the discussion for me to get into it. I'm reading some of this now. I have simulated a dipole antenna with a different length. And then when I find the input impedance, I find that I have some positive values for the reactance and some negative values. And the question is why? I got those answers, and how does the reactance affect the performance of the antenna? It's not my question, it's just what I'm reading. And my question is, are we talking about a dipole with a separate feed that is underneath of it, and that's why the reactances are involved, so the capacitive reactance would then take place, or are we talking about the thickness of the wire, say? Dipole with 3 feet long vertically sheet of metal, and the length of that dipole arm is exactly as supposed to be, and then we have another one, the two arms, so now we have a two vertical sheets of metal at a certain height, so we want to exclude the earth and that factor. Now we have a wire, let's say a 14-gauge wire, that is a second antenna, and both of them are far away. We're just trying to compare how the one would react versus the other. And to
engineer. When you set up a half-wave, quarter-wave, whatever, resonant antenna, dipole, monopole, and so on, depending on how you put sheets of metal nearby, depending on how you put other kinds of antennas nearby, depending on whether the other antennas are connected to the same antenna, like a fan dipole, or whether or not they're connected to different transmission lines, there's a zillion different conditions by which your antenna of interest looks into that environment. It's not seeing pure empty space. It's seeing other metallic objects nearby. The other metallic objects are wide, narrow, long, short, above resonance, below resonance, tuned to other frequencies, connected to other feed lines. There's a zillion different ways you can put other objects in the near field of your antenna and make the impedance of your antenna do anything you want. The series of curves that were done by Brown and Woodward, the so-called Brown and Woodward curves that you'll find in the Antenna Engineering Handbook in Chapter 4, We'll show you what happens if you make the radiator diamond-shaped instead of a simple piece of wire, what happens when you change the diameter and wavelength, the diameter to length ratio. There's a zillion things you can do. And by the way, let me drop... If you put sheets of metal nearby to a dipole, and the dipole is in between those sheets of metal, you're moving in the direction of generating a whole class of dipole-like antennas that's called a sleeve dipole. There's a whole way you can set up a dipole where the first few percent of the dipole is a piece of coaxial cable with the shield connected in the center, and you're feeding the center conductor, and then the center conductor sticks out beyond that shield at the ends. That's a sleeve dipole. Set up correctly, it gives you a hell of a lot more bandwidth of a dipole. Not many of us do that. There's all kinds of tricky ways of making a dipole have greater standing wave ratio bandwidth and reasonable amount of gain. The bottom line of all this is that your radiating system, it is easier to make it a quarter wave or a half wave resonant length. That's the classic way of doing it. And when you do that, we have classic ways of feeding it where you see 37 ohms or 70 ohms and so on, known impedances. There isn't anything magic about the length of the radiator that you use for the antenna if you're smart enough. Let me drop.
Thickness is not, say you have ideal situation, thickness of the wire.
It's one of a zillion variables you've got in your hand is whether or not some of it is shielded, whether or not some of it is wider in thickness and narrower in thickness, whether or not it's tapered, whether it's diamond-shaped and so on. There's a zillion different variations. No matter how you set up what you want to be a radiator, as long as you are smart enough to measure the real impedance by way of the Berkeley program, you Google the words Berkeley and an impedance match, and you'll find this beautiful program where if you know the resistive component and the reactive component of your particular antenna, which could be way off resonance, where the resistive component is 5 ohms and the reactive component is 1,000 ohms of capacitive reactance because it's a short antenna. Let me drop. You plug those numbers into the Berkeley program. It'll give you 16 separate answers. One of those answers is a simple L network, a certain inductor, a certain capacitor in series with each other, and at the junction of the two, you connect your antenna. And that network, designed for you instantaneously by Berkeley, will correct the reactive component, will correct the resistive component, will make your antenna be a 50-ohm input, if that's what you want, even though it's a non-resonant length. The way you radiate, the most important 7 words in the English language, if you are an antenna designer, and these words are not in any book, and I'm extremely displeased by that, the most 7 important words is, you resonate first, then it will radiate. No matter what your piece of wire is, you connect the right kind of impedance matching device to it, so you force it into resonance and you force it into reasonable impedance match to your particular transmitter and your particular transmission line, it'll radiate like crazy. Every one of the cell phones you're using are doing that. Let me drop it. That tiny little yucky antenna that's on that printed circuit board inside of the cell phone that you're now using that doesn't even have an external whip anymore because people don't want to see that whip. That antenna has now got to work on 4 different bands and a whole lot of percentage of bandwidth at all those bands. And did they design all of those antennas in there to do that? Absolutely not. Every one of those cell phones, if you study the schematic diagram, the functional block diagram, it has this integrated circuit chip right alongside of that antenna that is an antenna tuner. As your cell phone knows that it's going to go to frequency number 13, it knows it's got to go to step number 5 of the antenna tuner, and it programs that in while you're transmitting on that frequency. That antenna tuner, built into every one of your cell phones, takes that non-resonant length of wire that is the antenna in there, forces it into a good resonant electronic length and the right impedance match. The bottom line is that the thing that you call radiator, as long as you connect the right kind of a thing to it, balun, antenna tuner, the right kind of a feed line, C1 and C2 capacitors, your Pi network at the final stage of the transmitter, that whole radiating system, you force it into resonance in a good impedance match, even though the length is wrong, it will radiate 98% of the power you put into it. Because of the crazy length and the crazy orientation, let me drop. Because of the crazy length and the crazy orientation you've used for that particular radiating system, you may not be thoroughly happy with the antenna pattern you're going to get. But when it comes to radiation, if you're smart enough, radiation is easy. Radiating a radio signal, if you're smart enough, even with the wrong length of antenna, it's easy. If you don't have that particular piece of philosophy, resonate first, then it will radiate, then almost all the antennas you build will lead you to believe that radiation is hard. Very difficult to set up an antenna that works well. The smarts that's required to make that happen, once you understand the philosophy, that the signal is going to bounce back and forth in your antenna at least 10 times before it gets radiated, you are forced into making that antenna a resonant network so that all of those bounces, of that, those 10 bounces or more of that signal, stays in step, stays co-phase, stays coherent, so that the current can multiply and therefore it can radiate. That's the magic of resonance. I'm amazed that none of the good books say that. And yet, as an antenna designer for the last zillion years with a bunch of patents, I've used that philosophy, and for me it works. And I'm trying to propagate that philosophy, and so people are hearing it for the first time. It sounds strange, and I can understand how you don't jump on that bandwagon right away. But if you accept what I'm saying and then pursue it, I think most of the time you'll be happy with the results. I know we got kind of left of center of what you're asking, Steve, but maybe this helped. KD2HUC, K2LIW, the TechNet. Good question.
Nope. I'm in the process of stringing up a temporary random wire, and I wanted the wire to be not so random. You know, I am going to couple it with a decent MFJ tuner, but, and I was just, before I string it, I would like to have it somewhere in the realm of the right length, hence my question of, you know, the velocity factor, and I'll pick a happy medium of the, you know, of the 20, the 40, and the 80 bands, and, you know, try and get it close, and then let the tuner do the rest of the work. So that's the plan, as of right now. You think it'll work?
Almost all good ideas do not work at first, Steve. You're going to get some bugs at first. You're going to get some... Turns out that when you're building a random length of wire and you want it to work on all seven of the HF ham bands, for instance, very few of the antenna tuners you and I can buy have that much range. Some of the bands is going to work, some of the bands is not going to work. And the bands where it doesn't work, what's really going on is that I wish that the manufacturers of antenna tuners would give you a Smith chart, and on that Smith chart, they would color in the sections of the Smith chart. By the way, a Smith chart, it's a circular chart where left and right is the resistive component, up and down is the reactive component, and so as you put a dot on that Smith chart, it is the exact total impedance of your antenna, for instance, or anything else you're measuring the impedance of. And all the possible impedances in the world, from zero to infinity in resistance, and from negative infinity to positive infinity in reactance, all possible impedances of any object fall somewhere on that Smith chart. So all the impedances in the universe are on that Smith chart. Let me drop. And if the manufacturer of a antenna tuner had enough faith in the customers that are going to buy the thing, and if they had a good enough engineering staff, on each of the bands that we're going to use, the 80 band, the 40 meter band, the 20 meter band, they could make up a Smith chart for each one of those bands, and they could color in the portion of the chart that says that this brand and this model number of antenna tuner will cover all of the impedances in that colored in section. Then you as a scientist would know right away when you use your antenna analyzer, and you know that your antenna through the transmission line in the shack gives you this particular impedance, and you put the dot on the Smith chart, and if the dot is outside of the colored section, you'd know right away that your antenna tuner is not going to cover it. That's not a showstopper. It's just one more piece of information. Because if you increase the length of your transmission line, you don't change the standing wave ratio. You're just drawing a circle of that exact same radius. You're drawing that circle on the Smith chart as you add the extra transmission line. And 90-some-odd percent of the time, your dot that's outside of the colored-in section is now going to sweep into the colored-in section. So by adjusting... time when you're on the 40-meter band, where ordinarily your antenna tuner doesn't go there in your particular case. Now you've got to go to your particular case. Or the next step is you measure the real impedance in the shack with your antenna analyzer, and you go to the Berkeley chart, the Berkeley program, and it tells you how to design an L network that you add in cascade with your antenna tuner if you want to, and now you can impedance match it. So there isn't that much magic. Let me drop this. There isn't that much magic of measuring the impedance, finding out if your antenna tuner can go there, and if it doesn't, there's a zillion ways of collecting it, changing the length of a wire, changing the length of a transmission line, adding stub tuners, adding reactors, adding an L network designed by the Berkeley program. There's a zillion ways you can force the system to be not only resonant when it wasn't resonant, not only a good impedance match when it wasn't before. You can force everything to be a one-to-one standing wave ratio at the output of your transmitter if you're smart enough. You have the tools. Just, you've got to learn how to use those tools. You have to have the faith to, you have to make the leap, jump, and the leap of faith saying that it is solvable, that there isn't anything magic about a particular length of an antenna. The thing that you call antenna can be any length in the world within reason, and if you're smart enough, you can make it work 95% efficient on your particular frequency band. Ain't that crazy? KD2HUC, I wonder if you have ever heard anything like that before, Steve. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'll tell you, I didn't expect it was going to be easy. I was kind of hoping it would be a little less complicated, but I'm going to look into that Berkeley program and see if I can download it or get my hands on it, and then we'll take it from there. So, like I said, right now the first step is to get the wire strung, and I just wanted to try and get the length as close, you know, as reasonable to somewhere in the middle, you know, of all the bands. I've done that before where I've been able to calculate, you know, across multiple bands, a sweet spot, where, you know, that lines up. So hopefully I can do that again and apply it. So, but thanks for the info, and I'll let you know how I make out. KD2HUC.
Yeah, please do come back and tell us how it works, Steve. I've got even better news for you. You do not have to download the Berkeley program. You use it live. If you've got an antenna tuner that you can beg, borrow, or steal, and you measure the real impedance that your transmitter and or antenna tuner is seeing, you measure the real impedance in the shack or with the antenna, wherever you like, you measure the impedance. You Google the word Berkeley plus impedance match, and you'll get a website. And the website will ask you, what is the resistive component and the reactive component of your signal source? That's your transmitter. You're going to write down 50 ohms resistance and 0 ohms reactance. That's what the transmitter wants to see. The next piece of information Berkeley asks you is what frequency you're on, what is the resistive component, and what is the reactive component of your load, which in your case is the antenna. You simply fill in those squares when you're on the Berkeley site, and you press go. And it will give you 16 solutions with diagram, with the values. It tells you exactly how many microhenries of inductance, how many picofarads of capacitance, what layout of the inductor and capacitor for an L network, an upside down L network, a pi network, a T network, an L pi. It gives you 16 solutions in a fraction of a second. You choose the one that you like. You don't have to download the program. You simply plug in the information into the squares and press go, and there is the answer. As long as you've got an antenna, analyzer, or some other method by which you can measure the impedance of your unknown thing, in your case an antenna, you now, at that frequency at least, can do a perfect impedance match with very simple networks that you can wind that coil yourself by way of the... Let me drop it. Berkeley will tell you you need a 5.1 microhenry coil, okay? You go to the early chapters of the antenna, the Radio Amateur's Handbook, and you go to that formula, and the formula tells you that if you've got this many turns of wire, of this diameter of the turns, and this spacing of the turns, that you'll get a 5.6 microhenry inductor, and so on. So you can homebrew this thing by wrapping wire on a piece of PVC pipe, if that's what you want to do. So very inexpensive components can give you an ideal impedance match, and Berkeley gives you the answer. Don't even have to download the program and worry about how much memory it's going to fill up in your machine and whether or not it's going to corrupt your hard drive and so on. The answer is there. Ain't that nice, Steve? KD2HUC, K2RIW.
That is fantastic. I will go look at that site in the very immediate future. And now all I have to do is string the line and take the impedance measurement. All right, I think we can do this. I will certainly be back and let you know how I make out. Questions will follow. But thanks for the initial info, and come back next week. KD2HUC, back to net.
As you can see, Steve, the tools are in your hand. It's all available to you. It's going to take a little bit of work, but once you spend that little bit of work, once you learn these concepts, once you actually carry it out, once you come back in 1 week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or at least a couple more questions and you make this work with your own hands, you can take pride in it. And that knowledge you can tuck away into the back of your head and you can use it from now on. We amateur radio operators, we radiate signals and we communicate with people worldwide. And now we're teaching each other the best way to radiate those signals with inexpensive hardware that we can get a hold of or manufacture with our own hands, and then we can brag about the results. And in my particular case, the taller the antenna, the better. I just happen to love towers. Let's see what Hal's got to say about all of the above. K6DPZ, K2IW, go ahead, Hal.
I want to say a simple number when you want to figure out a random wire. Just take 15 megacycles, go into 246, and that'll give you the wire speed as a random wire. So that's my only comment. It works very well.
If you want to choose one of the classic lengths with the classic types of impedance matching, I agree. But if for reasons of not having enough property, wanted to lay out the wire differently, there's nothing magic about the particular length of the radiator. If you're smart enough, and that's what's going on inside of every one of our cell phones, if you're smart enough, any length of radiator, be it wire, rod, flat plate, whatever, no matter what it is, if you're smart enough, you can force it into resonance, you can force it into a good impedance match. It's just a matter of setting up the right LC network between your transmission line and that transmitter, and it will work like a charm. So there are classic lengths that we all use. We all think that a dipole has got to be exactly a half wavelength long. A ground plane has got to be a quarter wave or 5/8 wave long. These magic numbers, we think that no others will work. Absolutely not true. And on top of that, the dipole doesn't have to be fed in the center. You can feed it in the center, 10% off center, 50% off center, 80% off center. The outer edge, if you're smart enough, any of those will work with equal efficiency. Ain't that crazy? The next person who was on our list was John, KC2SHO. Go right ahead, John, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. My apologies, I forgot to bring my piece of notepaper with me. I'm upstairs getting my son ready for bath. I will just put the idea out. Maybe we can discuss it next week. I purchased recently a HP impedance analyzer, a LF, a low frequency impedance analyzer, and I can get that model number maybe next time comes around, but I'm just wondering if anybody has experience with that. We don't have to get into deep discussion about it tonight, but I haven't done any research on it yet, but I do find it to be a fascinating piece of test equipment, and do you think that's a valuable thing to use in the days of Smith charts and vector network analyzers that can be had relatively cheaply, but this is a little cheaper than you can find those, and just wondering if anybody has seen those, knows about it, and is it a valuable piece of gear? K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, that Hewlett-Packard company, which had its birth in Palo Alto, California, and I was there and I've seen that little garage where it all began, where Mr. Hewlett and Mr. Packard first built this Wien Bridge audio oscillator, the HP Model 200 audio oscillator, which put them on the map. Really genius of a simple circuit that worked like a charm. Over the years, they built a number of devices that could be called impedance analyzer. And nowadays, many of us will buy the things that we can buy for ham radio purposes. I'm trying to think of the names of the companies that sell it, but antenna analyzer, impedance analyzer, really has a strong degree of similarity. Whether it's called a vector network analyzer, whether it's called an antenna analyzer, whether it's called an impedance analyzer, in almost all cases, it falls into one or two categories. Let me drop it. In one category, you're setting up something called a Wheatstone bridge. A Wheatstone bridge really is a diamond-shaped circuit where you could say in each of the four corners of the diamond, each of the four wires of the diamond, you've got a 50-ohm resistor. And you apply your signal between the 12 o'clock point and the 6 o'clock point, and you've got a detector between the 3 o'clock point and the 9 o'clock point. When the Wien bridge circuit is thoroughly balanced, when the four legs have the exact same impedance, there will be a null on the signal detector between the 3 o'clock and the 9 o'clock position when you're putting a signal between 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock. And so by varying, you put your unknown impedance in one of those four legs, and then one of the other legs, you've got some kind of a variable resistor, variable capacitor circuit, and you tune it until you get a null. You're now measuring the impedance. The tuning you do on the third leg, your fourth leg is the unknown, the third leg is the one that you're tuning, and when you tune the third leg resistor and reactance just right, the circuit goes into a null, and you say, aha, I know the impedance. I can read it off the dial, if you know what I mean. That's one of the ways of doing it. Another way of doing it is that every real circuit that's on the end of a transmission line, let me drop it, is a circuit that's sensitive to impedance. By that I mean, if it's a 50-ohm transmission line, and if the load you put at the far end is a pure 50-ohm resistor, all the signal you send down that line goes into that load, every bit of it gets absorbed, none of it reflects. If the load is anything but a pure 50-ohm resistor, if it's a 48-ohm resistor or a 52-ohm resistor, in the case of a 48-ohm resistor, you're going to get a reflected signal of a known magnitude, pretty small, but it'll have 180-degree of phase reversal on reflection. If it's a higher impedance than 50 ohms, like 52 ohms, the signal you're going to reflect back is a small signal with 0 degrees of phase shift. If it's a reactance, you're going to get a slightly different phase shift. So by measuring the signal that reflects from the end of your transmission line, by way of a directional coupler and other techniques, you measure the magnitude of what reflects. That tells you the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. That's what your Bird wattmeter measures when you go to the forward and reverse mode. It's just measuring how much energy is reflecting versus how much is going forward. That gives you magnitude of this well with the lookup chart. Let me drop it. And if you go the next step of not only measuring the magnitude of the signal that's reflecting, but you measure the phase angle of the signal that's reflecting, it tells you exactly what the impedance was at the end of that line. That's what a vector network analyzer is. So as you can see, things that will measure impedance, there's a whole lot of ways of doing it, but they tend to fall into those two major classes. A Wheatstone bridge that either is or isn't balanced, and you rebalance it, or a circuit that can measure magnitude of reflection. If you measure nothing but magnitude, it's called a scalar network analyzer. If you measure magnitude and phase, it's called a vector network analyzer. And that once you know the reflected signal in magnitude and phase angle, that gives you an exact location dot on that Smith chart. Therefore, you know the impedance, and you know almost everything you want to know. Once you're smart enough to know how to use a Smith chart, and vector network analyzers nowadays are, there's various ways you can buy very inexpensive ones. When it comes over to John, KC2WGB, I believe he's bought a fairly inexpensive one, or knows of a fairly inexpensive one. He's bought a brand new spectrum analyzer at a very great price recently, and I think he knows of various network analyzers, vector network analyzers, scalar network analyzers, that if you want one bad enough, you don't have to spend a whole lot of money to get one. And when you get a club, let me drop. When you get a club with as many members as this particular club, LIMARC, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, it's just a matter of time before somebody comes before the board and says, gee, we got all these members that would like to make measurements, maybe 10% of them want, but still 10% of a club of 400 people is 40 people. We got 40 people that would like to make real measurements. Maybe the club should buy a spectrum analyzer, buy a vector network analyzer, buy a spare Bird wattmeter, and we loan it out to the various members so they don't have to pay the price. I mean, when you and I buy an expensive piece of test equipment, the good news is it looks pretty on the shelf. We get some great measurements when it's brand new. But a year downrange, you find out you're only using it 2 days a year, and therefore the ownership is a little bit wasteful. Whereas if you're a club member,